Blog Talk Radio.
Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It's always great to catch up with you at the end of the week, presuming that you're listening to this program live and not as part of a podcast. But in any event, it is May the 6th, 2016. The clock keeps on moving, and the events of the day keep on coming at us faster than a freight train. So it is great to catch up with you. Thank you for joining me. Those of you who are familiar with me know that I'm a retired senior special agent of the former Immigration and Naturalization Service, and that ever since the terrorist attacks of 9/11, my mission, as it were, has been to inform as many of our fellow Americans, as many of our leaders, about the true significance of America's borders and America's immigration laws. And I want to remind you that when we speak about our borders, we're not just talking about the Mexican border. Even though that border that absolutely must be secured is only one of many elements of an entire overarching immigration system. We have 328 ports of entry scattered along both the northern and southern borders, located at international airports and located at seaports along America's 95,000 miles of meandering coastline. So immigration is a system. It's not just a Mexican border. And as you know, the immigration laws are not about any specific race, religion, or ethnicity. And we're going to get a little bit into this. My rage at the nonsense about immigration and the Latino vote and the kind of disgusting profiling that that concept represents should be appalling to all of us. In fact, I wrote an article not long ago for Front Page Magazine where I took on the issue of these pollsters who have cubbyholed Americans, you know, the black vote, the Latino vote, the Jewish vote, the middle class vote. We're Americans, and we are a diverse people, and I've traveled all over this amazing country, and I've met with our fellow Americans of every race, every religion, every ethnicity, every way of seeing the universe, people who go to the supermarket for a bunch of meat, or people who grab their rifle and go out deer hunting for some meat. We live so differently, but yet when you get beneath the superficial, for the most part, there is far more that unites us than divides us, and the pollsters and these 24-hour news cycle programs that breathlessly hang on so much of the nonsense that they spew is really doing us a disservice. It almost amounts to a divide-and-conquer strategy, and we've got to push back. And I think that's what the Donald Trump candidacy has been about, going after the old guard and the old ideas and the betrayals by both political parties of America and Americans. And that's the purpose to my program, to tell the truth. The truth not based on some brain spasm I had last week, but on 30 years of real-world experience that I acquired throughout my 30-year career with the former Immigration and Naturalization Service, and then have added to that experience base by having been before numerous congressional hearings, providing testimony at state legislative hearings around the country, and it has been an eye-opener. You know, once you're out there and you're confronted by the truth, it's hard to buy the pablum, the lies, the nonsense, the propaganda, if you will. Pardon me. Wow. Kermit the Frog has set up shop in my throat this evening, but I'm doing fine. But again, that's why I'm here. And those of you familiar with me know about my websites. If you're new to the program, I ask you to go to michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R. That's my own personal website. I also have been for years associated with a terrific organization out in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. My friends at Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org is their website. I've been writing for them for years. I'm also a columnist for the Front Page magazine that has sponsored a production of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Very proud to be working with David Horowitz and his group. And I write for The Social Contract. And of late, I've been doing numerous television appearances on Newsmax TV, principally on DML Unfiltered, DML being Dennis Michael Lynch, a guy who put together several documentaries on immigration. I am in a couple of those documentaries. I've also been appearing on One American News Network. What's noteworthy is where I've not been appearing. In the months after 9/11, I was averaging at least a dozen, perhaps more, television interviews on news network programs across the spectrum. CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, ABC News. There was a real concern about looking at the nexus, and there's a very clear nexus, between failures of the immigration system and the ability of terrorists and transnational criminals to enter the United States and ply their deadly trades, as it were, across our nation, and as a consequence, killing so many innocent victims. But too much money has been expended on pushing the open border agenda. And they have, the open borders anarchists, have done an incredible job of somehow convincing people that any discussion about immigration is based on race. It is a big, fat lie. And, you know, if you look at my own family's background, I was named for my grandmother who was killed in Poland during the Holocaust. The Holocaust was the outgrowth of bigotry, racism, anti-Semitism, blind hate. There is no way on God's green earth that I could have enforced any laws that distinguished people by race, religion, or ethnicity. And I've said it before, but I think it's worth repeating, that the purpose of our immigration laws is to keep out those foreign nationals who pose a threat to our safety and well-being. And the grounds for excluding an alien are so crystal clear on the point. It's about keeping out aliens who suffer from dangerous communicable diseases. Let's remember, Ellis Island was a quarantine station. And along a parallel line, it's also about keeping out aliens who suffer severe mental illness and are prone to violence or are sex offenders, various criminals, bank robbers, murderers, rapists, child molesters, gang members, gun runners, money launderers, people who would commit terrible crimes. It's about keeping out fugitives from justice and people who are war criminals, spies, and terrorists, and human rights violators. It's about keeping out aliens who are likely to become a public charge, or aliens who, if they worked illegally, would displace American workers and or, at the very least, drive down wages of American workers who were similarly employed. We built the middle class, this great nation did, during the greatest generation, by making certain that American workers would not compete with foreign workers for jobs. Our politicians back then, the greatest generation, understood that for America to do well, Americans must do well. Not so much today, folks. And we're going to get into that. But what I really want to start out with, and I noted it on the USA Talk Radio Network, the network that is where my show is located, is to talk about immigration fraud. Fraud needs to be thought of as a lie on paper that provides the person who commits the fraud with something that which he or she would not be entitled to if all the accurate material facts were known. And immigration fraud was found to be, by the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, fraud was found to be a critically important element and created critical vulnerabilities for America, where not only the 9/11 terrorist attacks were concerned, but terrorist attacks that were planned in the decade leading up to that god-awful day on September 11, 2001. We had aliens coming in with false passports, aliens coming in with visas in which they had lied when they applied for the visas. We had aliens who were granted political asylum. Ramzi Youssef, for example, was granted political asylum prior to his participation in the 1993 deadly World Trade Center bombing attack, in which six people were killed, more than 1,000 people were injured. About $500 million in damages was inflicted on that World Trade Center complex in Lower Manhattan back in 1993. And I don't know if you know it, but the Vista Hotel, which was a part of that complex, brand new hotel, when that bomb went off in the garage, the hotel damn near collapsed into its own foundation. This was not a minor incident, and yet the Clinton administration did nothing in response to it. Bill Clinton didn't even come to New York. Never mind 1,000 injuries. Never mind 6 people dead. Never mind that if they had toppled the tower, and according to friends who worked on that investigation of the actual bombing told me, that engineers who were brought in told them that the odds were quite good that if the bomb had been planted on the opposite wall of that garage, apparently somebody had parked there, history might have written a very different story about February 26, 1993, the date of that bombing at the Trade Center. Because if they had parked the car on that opposite wall, that Ryder rental truck, if they had filled the truck to the top with explosives, because they did not, if either of those two things had happened, and more likely, if both of those things had happened, the World Trade Center would have come down sideways. For those of you not familiar with New York or tall buildings, the World Trade Center stood more than 1,400 feet tall, roughly a quarter of a mile into the sky, 110 floors. The complex was, and now the new complex is, a vertical city. Tens of thousands of people working there every day. Can you imagine a building 110 stories tall, a quarter of a mile high, falling over sideways? It would have collided with other buildings. It would have ruptured gas lines. The sea wall would have ruptured. Lower Manhattan would have been flooded. All the way from the tip of Manhattan, where the ferry boats are, Wall Street, the financial center, all of it would have been underwater. And there is a street that runs east to west above Lower Manhattan, Canal Street, kind of a demarcation line. It might well have had a new meaning, Canal Street. And yet the Clinton administration did nothing. On May 20th, 1997, I testified before my very first hearing, and that hearing was called by the House Immigration Subcommittee because of the attack at the Trade Center in 1993 and the fact that 1 month earlier, January 93, a Pakistani national by the name of Mir Almil Kansi, a guy who entered the United States on a visa, subsequently filed a fraudulent application for political asylum, bought into a courier service, so he had access to a truck that delivered packages, permission to drive into the CIA compound parking area. And on a cold January morning, Almil Kansi in 1993 brought with him a piece of unusual hardware, an accessory, an AK-47. He got into the parking lot in the morning, and as CIA employees were driving to work that morning, he opened fire, he killed 2 CIA officers, wounded 3 others, and then fled the country. And that was the reason that we had that hearing 4 and a half years later, May 20th, 1997, which is also about 4 years prior to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And the topic was to look at visa fraud, immigration fraud, because of what Kansi did at the CIA and those other Middle Eastern thugs did at the World Trade Center. So it was clear to everybody that we have a problem with immigration, we have a problem with visas. But it was a problem that the Clinton administration and the other globalists did not want to hear about. And when I say other globalists, I would include in that Ronald Reagan, the president who gave us not only the first amnesty, but refused to hire more immigration agents. And part of the amnesty of 86, and you may not know this, was to shield information in amnesty files from exploration by discovery by other law enforcement agencies. I had occasion when police officers, homicide detectives, DEA agents, U.S. Marshals, and even FBI agents would approach me and say, Mike, I need a photograph. I need an address. I'm looking for this guy. We think he committed a murder. We think he may commit more murders. But because of the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986 that provided the amnesty, and Reagan signed it, there was a provision that said that I could not, as an immigration officer, share the amnesty file with any other law enforcement agency. A subpoena had to first be secured from a federal judge, but that if I or any other immigration officer handed over the amnesty file, we were looking at a jail sentence and the loss of our jobs and our pensions. Outrageous. If you're a legal immigrant, came here in accordance with the laws that I support, then we would have to turn that over. And of course we would. Why wouldn't we? If you were a naturalized citizen and some FBI agent came knocking on the door and said, we need the file, we had to turn it over. Otherwise, it's obstruction of justice. But if the part of the file related to an illegal alien who was granted amnesty, that file was off limits. How does that protect America or Americans? I'm very angry about the Obama administration and its executive orders, and on April the 18th of this year, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about the DAPA cases, the deferred action parents of lawful aliens and so forth. You know, so everyone's angry about the executive orders. But you may not know this, but President George W. Bush issued an executive order that protected illegal aliens under the privacy laws. The Privacy Act was enacted in response to snooping on Americans by the intelligence services back in the 1970s. So the antidote was the privacy laws. And what the privacy laws said was, we have to protect the privacy of United States citizens and lawful immigrant aliens, aliens with green cards. Not just that they're here legally, not that they're here on student visas or foreign work visas or any of that other business, temporary work visas, but that they had green cards or they were citizens. And George W. Bush, from what I've read, with the counseling and insistence of Michael Chertoff, the head of DHS, the Department of Homeland Surrender, as I have come to call it, said, you know what, by executive action, we're going to make sure that nobody can find out anything about criminal aliens, even when they go out and kill people. Let's protect them from disclosure. How in the world does that protect us? And in fact, I wrote about this in a couple of recent articles, especially for Front Page Magazine and CapsWeb.org. I participated in a hearing 44 months after 9/11. And it was on what was happening to the enforcement of our immigration laws now that we had dual mission agents, people doing customs as well as immigration laws when they created ICE under the DHS. And what was astonishing, and I remember sitting at that hearing, and I've discussed this before, but I just have to make mention of it, was that Richard Stannett was one of the other four witnesses at this hearing at which I testified. And Stannett said, 44 months after 9/11, we were still trying to put together mission statements and priorities for the enforcement of our immigration laws. I was flabbergasted. I was flabbergasted because it took us 44 months to win the Second World War. The greatest generation in 44 months put together a powerful coalition, the Allies. We built fleets of thousands of airplanes, bombers, pursuit craft, fighter planes, thousands of ships, Liberty ships, PT boats, submarines, aircraft carriers, battleships, destroyers. We built nuclear weapons, all in 44 months. Here we were, 44 months after the worst terrorist attack committed on U.S. soil, an attack that resulted in more casualties than we suffered at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. And again, the parallel is striking. It took just 19 terrorists barely out of their teens, most of whom had little in the way of formal education, just 19 goons to rack up more casualties on our country than did the entire Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor. But in response to Pearl Harbor, we mobilized and we proved who we are. We are Americans. 44 months, we won the Second World War with our allies. Think about D-Day. Think about the achievements. Think about the valor, the bravery, the commitment. 44 months after the worst terrorist attack, Our brilliant leaders in Washington couldn't even come up with a mission statement for the enforcement of our immigration laws that clearly were the root cause. The failures of that system were at the root cause of the ability of terrorists to enter the United States and embed themselves in the United States. 6 months after 9/11, to everybody's horror, it was discovered that two of the dead terrorists of 9/11, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, had been granted authorization to attend flight school. Flight school! These bums were hijackers. We knew it. We knew they were dead. But yet 6 months after the attacks, the inept, dysfunctional, and thoroughly screwed up Immigration and Naturalization Service, soon to be ICE, granted authorization to two dead terrorists to go to flight school. You can still see that hearing on videotape on C-SPAN. It's part of their permanent library. That hearing was held more than 14 years ago. And not a single promise made at that hearing by angered and indignant members of Congress has been kept to this day. And what's remarkable is that some of those members of Congress, including one who invited me to testify at that hearing, made it clear that immigration was the key issue. Immigration was the vulnerability. Immigration needed to be fixed. 2 months later, I'm sitting at a hearing with some of those very same members of Congress, and when I talked about the vulnerabilities of immigration and the vulnerabilities that it exposes us to where terrorism is concerned, the same people said to me, Mr. Cutler, immigration has absolutely nothing, not a damn thing to do with terrorism. When I was a kid, long time ago, there was a movie, The Invaders from Mars. Those of you old enough to remember it will know that this kid has a nightmare. He dreams that a flying saucer lands in his backyard, and they take over the brains of the townspeople. And when the brain is taken over, they put a little nub in the back of the neck of the townspeople. And it happened to his parents. It happened to the chief of police, and on and on. It's a classic 50s thriller. And then he wakes up and realizes it was all a dream, and as he's falling asleep again, he sees the flying saucer as he's awake, he believes, landing in his backyard, and so it begins. And I keep thinking of Invaders from Mars, and when I'm in Washington, I find myself wandering the halls of Congress looking to see who's wearing that little nub in the back of the neck, who's controlling the brain of these imbeciles who call themselves our elected representatives. Because I know they've got to have nubs or something in there controlling their feeble brains. It makes no sense. Immigration fraud was pivotal. And look at where it got us. You had Mahmoud Abu Alima, who got agricultural fraud. He was part of the 93 attack, a la Chuck Schumer. We've had people getting political asylum. I had mentioned Ramzi Youssef got political asylum. We have the Times Square bomber, Faisal Shahzad, 2010, set off that SUV car bomb. Thankfully, it did not blow up. It did not go kaboom. It just went poof, and nobody got hurt. But this guy came in on a student visa, got involved with a marriage, apparently a sham marriage, a fraud marriage, became a United States citizen just months before he launched that terror attack. Yet the head of New York City Police Department, Ray Kelly, describes Faisal Shahzad as a classic example of a homegrown terrorist. Never mind he came here at the age of 20. Never mind that he obviously lied on his application for citizenship or for his green card or probably for everything else that he did where immigration was concerned. And in fact, when the judge at sentencing, who sentenced him basically to a life sentence, said to Mr. Shahzad, you took an oath. You said you were going to be an American, that you wanted our freedom. Why did you do this? He said, I lied. It was a false oath. I hate your country. I don't need your freedom. Sharia gives me all the freedom I need. You look at what happened at the Boston Marathon bombing. You had the Tsarnaev family come to the United States, claim political asylum, and as soon as we said you have political asylum, which means they articulated a credible fear that they can no longer go back to Russia without facing persecution or perhaps worse, they voluntarily went back to Russia. I mean, look, that's a prima facie case right there that they lied, that they committed fraud. If you come in and say we can't go home because we will face persecution or worse, and we give you lawful status and you go home, you think maybe they lied? The Congress tried to pass a bill that would automatically strip you of political asylum if you returned to your home country voluntarily and there was no regime change. What could be more reasonable or common sense? I mean, they don't even need that. All they need to do is prosecute these people for lying, for God's sakes. But we can't get legislation enacted that has anything to do with enforcement. That's where we are because of both political parties. So you would have thought after the Faisal Shahzad case, you would have thought after 9/11, you would have thought after 93, you would have thought after the Boston bombing that we'd be scrutinizing immigration applications for fraud, that we'd be paying attention, especially when the aliens in question come from countries that sponsor terrorism. You'd be wrong. December 2nd, 2015, we have the San Bernardino terror attack. That loving couple who got their hands on heavy-duty weapons and mowed down a bunch of innocent people that they knew personally, that they had worked with, who had given them gifts. And then they go into that building at a party and kill them at a Christmas party. Think about that. Well, it turns out that the guy that provided them with the weapons, Marquez, not only is now being charged with aiding and abetting terrorists, providing material support to with those weapons and God knows what else he gave them, but now apparently he allegedly engaged in a marriage fraud with the sister-in-law, of the guy who shot up San Bernardino. And two other people are also involved in the conspiracy, plus the woman. So we're talking about four of them. The three stooges that were arrested, and the fourth stooge who's already been sitting in jail for his role in the alleged role in the terror attack in San Bernardino. Now, here's a couple of questions that the media didn't cover. And by the way, it's remarkable if you go to the ICE website, they don't even make note of the fact that these folks came here from Pakistan. Increasingly, the immigration websites, the U.S. government websites, don't even want to tell you when someone's from another country. You know, Chicago man commits a rape, and then you find out the guy came here illegally, or the guy overstayed a visa. But they don't portray the truth. They don't tell you, well, the guy came here on a student visa and then overstayed, or didn't go to school, or ran the border, or stowed away on a ship. Oh, no, we're not going to talk about that. So here you have this case of these people involved in an apparent marriage fraud, and they shoot, and the people that they're involved with carry out the worst terrorist attack since 9/11 on American soil. What no one is asking, and maybe we should be asking, is what's the possibility that maybe the reason these other folks were here was to carry out another attack? Maybe not. But, in law enforcement, we have an expression that if you see a coincidence, you need to look again. You need to look again. But now, here's the amazing thing. This guy Marquez, the American, the guy that bought the weapons allegedly used by the murderers, and his bride, Sharnik, who apparently he was not living with, was supposed to go to have an interview by immigration authorities in San Bernardino on December the 3rd, 2015, the day after the terrorist attack. I mean, think about this. They're going for an interview, the Joint Terrorism Task Force racing against the clock to gather up all that they can before people disappear, before evidence is destroyed. You're racing the clock in a case like this. I've been involved with terrorism investigations and major criminal investigations, and the clock is not your friend. Every second means that the bad guys have another second to put distance between them and you. Every second gives them an opportunity to destroy evidence and cover their tracks. The race is on. You're working 24/7. No one's sleeping, no one's showering, no one's thinking about anything but getting the job done. It's like being in the military. You know, your own needs are out the window. There's a goal that must be accomplished. Maybe there's more attacks coming. Maybe more people are about to die. We need to know what's going on. Are there other players out there? Is something else coming this way? Put yourself in that mindset. JTTF, tells ICE, you know that they're going to be having an interview with the guy that allegedly provided the guns. Get your hands on him. Go to immigration. This is Citizenship and Immigration Services. Hold on to that guy. Get a hold of any paperwork that he filed, and we're on our way. The ICE agents race down to the Office of United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, a division of DHS. Now, remember, I was an adjudications officer. I worked hand in glove with the agents. I ultimately became an agent, and then I worked hand in glove with the adjudicators. They're the ones who make the decision. They're the ones who give out the green cards and the citizenship. They're the ones who open the doors to the terrorists and to criminals and decent people also. But it's a serious job. They're America's locksmith, if you will. So the ICE agents, under the direction of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, go to DHS, to Citizenship and Immigration Services, and the managers see them there. They said, what are you doing here? And they said, look, we had a terror attack down the road just yesterday, and I'm sure the manager said, yeah, we know all about the attack. What's that got to do with you? Well, one of the guys that we think provided the support that made the attack possible, that killed all those innocent people, still in the morgue, the smell of cordite still hanging in the air. We need to see him if he shows up. Turns out he didn't show up. But what I'm going to tell you now will blow your mind. Guess what the reaction of this manager from the Department of Homeland Surrender was to agents looking for the guy that provided, allegedly provided, the guns to the killers. They threw the agents out of the office and said, get out of here. You don't belong here. Leave. And they said, we need the file. We're not going to give you anything. And finally, I guess there was a lot of begging involved. God only knows. They got a photograph, a copy of a photo, but not a copy of the files. This is the day after the terrorist attack. First of all, if an agent showed up when I was an adjudicator, whatever they wanted, they got it. If they wanted my desk, they had my desk. Today, immigration enforcement agents are treated like the enemy, by their own agency. Can you imagine a more reprehensible situation? And I started the program by talking about the history of fraud and terrorist attacks. It was clear to everybody that there was a very clear nexus between immigration fraud and the ability of terrorists to conduct their attacks. In fact, if you look at what the 9/11 Commission had to say in the 9/11 Commission staff report, and I mean, it's volume upon volume upon volume. That's why I really want you to go to capsweb.org, C-A-P-S. You can see my articles. Go to Front Page Magazine. But I want you to listen to this passage. This is from the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. This is an official government document printed by the government printing office, available for my favorite price, free, online. This report was written by the attorneys and the special agents assigned to work with the 9/11 Commission. So this isn't the supermarket tabloid. This isn't the comic book, okay? This is an actual government report. It's an official report. Page 47 says the following. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. For example, Yusuf and Ajaj concocted bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Alima, involved in both the World Trade Center and Landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agriculture Worker Program after falsely claiming that he'd picked beans in Florida. It gets worse. Page 98, the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. Is there anything that could be more crystal clear than what I just read to you? This is an official government report that was prepared supposedly to make damn sure it wouldn't happen to us again. And ICE agents operating in conjunction with JTTF, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, show up at an office of Citizenship and Immigration Services and said, we need to speak to this guy, and they are told, get the hell out of here, you don't belong here. They said, can we have the files? No. If I had my way, those managers would be in jail for 20 years. Because imagine if another attack had been in the planning stage and getting a hold of this guy would have opened up that window that we would have needed to save more lives. The day after this terrorist attack is carried out, the people in the town had to be walking around in a state of shock. And our own government that's supposed to protect us if it does nothing else for us told the agents to keep on walking, and they threw them physically out of the building. Ron Johnson, the senator who chairs the Homeland Security Committee, held a hearing. And the people at USCIS, the directors there, well, you know, there was a mistake. They didn't understand. There was a miss of communication. Listen, I don't care if they thought these guys were shoplifting. There's supposed to be integrity to the process whereby we give green cards to people. We always wanted to know if there was information, derogatory information, so you don't give a green card to a shoplifter, let alone a damn terrorist. What miscommunication? They didn't know that they were really terrorists? So what? These are ICE agents. They're supposed to work in coordination with the agency that gives out the green cards. They were treated like the enemy because to this administration and to all too many Republicans, immigration enforcement officers are the enemy. Are the enemy. I'll repeat it five more times. These politicians believe that anybody who enforces the immigration laws are the enemy. And you know, I find it remarkable that George W. Bush, who had no problem locking up Border Patrol agents who put their lives on the line down on the Mexican border trying to stop a drug dealer, he and his father have now said, well, they're not going to go to the convention because Trump has been is the apparent nominee. If ever there was a doubt in my mind who I want to vote to, the Bushies convinced me who I'm definitely going to want to vote for. It was George W. Bush who prosecuted those agents who put their lives on the line. And one poor guy wound up in solitary confinement for, I believe, over a year. God forbid you should do that to a terrorist who chopped someone's head off. They'd have a cow. You're violating their civil rights. But a Border Patrol agent protecting that border from a drug dealer, and they concealed from the agents and their attorneys the fact that this guy had been stopped previously and subsequently moving huge amounts of drugs into the United States. They don't like Trump. The sacred Mexican border, the American lives that are nothing more than collateral damage when they're killed, government of the people, by the people, for the people, Abe Lincoln must be pinwheeling in his grave. If the politicians wonder why people look down at them like a bowl of warm puke, understand what's happening. I am furious, and if I sound furious, I mean to because I am. You know, the arguments between the liberals and conservatives, and I'm a registered Democrat, I figured myself to be a middle-of-the-road kind of guy, but pro-labor. But the difference between Democrats and Republicans very often is about the role of government. But nobody, and I mean nobody, seems to disagree that if government does nothing else, it's about national security and public safety. Well, how the hell are you looking after both of those or either of those when you're obstructing agents who are looking for terrorists? Why is nobody in jail? Why are they getting away with this lunacy? And again, I have to tell you, that there was a very real concern the day after that terrorist attack in San Bernardino that there might well have been follow-on attacks the way we saw in Paris, the way we saw in Boston. And ICE agents show up to a division within their own agency and they are thrown out of the building and no one is fired? I want to know who those managers are, and I'd love to see the next president send these people away. If not, provide them with free room and board for a long time. We are at war with terrorists. We stand on long lines being X-rayed by these machines, some of which, it's my understanding, were manufactured by the company that Michael Chertoff is now in charge of. We don't want to get on an airplane with terrorists. Well, no airplanes were involved in the Boston Marathon. No airplanes were involved in the bombing at Times Square that thankfully failed. No airplanes were involved in San Bernardino. But when immigration agents are told, we will not cooperate with you, and when the Republican-controlled Senate and House can sign off on Mr. Obama's omnibus spending bill and not do anything with sanctuary cities. This is Orwellian. This isn't political correctness. Donald Trump is wrong. We're not being politically correct. We are being Orwellian. Sanctuary. I mean, think what that word conjures up. I think of animal refuge, a place of comfort, a place of safety, a place of warmth. Sanctuary for illegal aliens. Chuck Schumer says when you trespass on the Brooklyn Bridge, when you trespass on the Manhattan Bridge, when you trespass on the Trade Center, or the Statue of Liberty, it ought to be a federal crime, and you ought to go to jail for 5 years. Schumer said it. 5 years in a cage because you're stupid enough to climb one of the cables at the Brooklyn Bridge to take an artsy photograph of the Statue of Liberty. In Schumer world, you should be in a cage. But when you come across that border that's supposed to protect us, and you sneak in the dead of night, now Chucky Baby says it's time to give you citizenship. This is lunacy. It is a betrayal of our country. It is a betrayal of our citizens. It's insane. And Donald Trump pointed something else out. The primary process. You know, we go vote in the primary because we want to pick the people that are going to be running for office. And it turns out that where the presidential primary is concerned, maybe we really don't vote for the candidate. When they talk about throwing Trump out, even though lots of Republicans said, this is our guy. Is this really a democracy? And we have become such foolish people in this country. We've become such fools. You know, you look at what people are willing to tolerate. My father told me that I would demonstrate to people how they should treat me by making clear what I was willing to accept. We have allowed our politicians to turn America's welcome mat into a doormat. We're importing foreign workers. We're firing Americans. We're witnessing a massive influx of narcotics and criminals into the United States. And let's face it, dead is dead. There isn't a lick of common sense behind anything that we're doing. You know, I just find it remarkable. We've told terrorists that schools are gun-free zones. So if you're a terrorist, you know that if you go to a school, you're not likely to encounter any resistance. What a brilliant idea. You think about what happened in Beslan when the terrorists did what they did in Russia. Do you really want to advertise that these are gun-free zones? I mean, does anybody really think that a terrorist intent on attacking a school is going to see the sign that says gun-free zone, and he's going to turn around and run to the nearest garbage can and throw his bomb and his gun in the garbage can? Why don't we put up signs that say terrorist-free zone, for God's sakes? We are committing suicide as a nation. The communists said the capitalists will sell you the rope with which you will hang them. We are having a fire sale on rope. And I have to give you a little update on the Zika business, you know, the Zika virus. I may have spoken about it last week, I don't recall, but in any event, a couple of months ago, Zika hit the headline, and I was on my way to Kansas City to deliver a speech. I do quite a few speaking engagements around the country. Next week, in fact, I'm heading to Florida. And it was remarkable, because as soon as the word about the Zika virus got out, all the guys in the white lab coats came out and said, oh, nothing to see here, folks. It's only transmitted by mosquito. You can only get the Zika virus by being bitten by a mosquito. Okay. So I went online. I was curious because I really don't trust our politicians. Believe it or not, folks, they tend to lie. What a horrible thought. They actually lie. Could you imagine that? Well, it said 2013, the Center for Disease Control established that the Zika virus can be transmitted through sexual contact. Not exactly what we were hearing, was it? So I get to Kansas. I wake up in the morning. I'm all excited. We're going to do this event. And they take me to the venue that night. And on my, by the way, when I get up, I'm having breakfast. I catch the news. And what did they talk about? Some guy in Houston, Texas, contracted the Zika virus through, drum roll, please, sexual contact. Well, this was too good an opportunity to pass up. I always tell people, if you're going to get in front of an audience, never be accused of being an unlicensed anesthesiologist. Keep it interesting. So I get up on stage, beautiful theater. It was like an old-time movie house back in the 20s. I understand it was a burlesque joint. And then they took out the chairs and turned it into a supper club. Big movie marquee, the whole bit, and the audience was packed. The house was packed. It was really thrilling to be there. And I thought I'd have a little bit of fun. And so I started to talk about the Zika virus and the way that the news gets twisted, often because of immigration, believe it or not. And I said, you know, we've been told that the Zika virus can only be transmitted by mosquitoes. That's contradicted by what's on the web over at the CDC from a couple of years back in 2013. But in any event, this morning it was released, the information was released that a guy in Houston, Texas, contracted the Zika virus through sexual contact. So I'm going to offer anybody in the audience a reward. All you have to do to qualify for my reward is come up with a glossy 8x10 photograph, hopefully in living color, of this guy having sex, apparently, with a mosquito. Well, now they are finding out, by the way, and the audience thought it was very funny. Well, now there's a big problem with the Zika virus. Where? In Puerto Rico. They've canceled baseball games. That's how much the concern is about the Zika virus. But, of course, they've allocated money, and we're going to try to help Puerto Rico deal with this problem that supposedly is all about the mosquito. So they are now sending airplanes filled with supplies to help Puerto Rico cope with the Zika virus. Guess what they're sending them to Puerto Rico? No, well, maybe they're sending insecticide. I don't know. But what was really remarkable was I just read a report where they're sending tons of, drum roll please, condoms, prophylactics. But there's nothing to see here, folks, because if you start to talk about people carrying the disease, then the first thing someone is likely to ask is what happens when people sneak into the country from Latin America, where this thing seems to be most prevalent, because the initial cases seem to have begun in Brazil, which, for those of our idiot politicians in Washington, if they can't figure it out and they don't know how to look at a map, it's in Latin America. So we're sending prophylactics to Puerto Rico. I was on a radio show earlier today, my good friend Annie Ubelis, she's a former New York City police officer, and I said, isn't it remarkable that the prophylactics are sending prophylactics to Puerto Rico? This is insanity, folks. I think the Russians, or when it was the Soviet Union, were telling more truth to their citizens in the Soviet Union through Pravda and Izvestia than we're getting out of our own news media here in the United States of America. It's lie after lie after lie, and it is Orwellian. And there's a reason for it, because too many people are making too much goddamn money off of the exploitation of cheap labor, foreign students, and foreign tourists. Insane. And if we don't turn this around, if we don't deal with this crisis will deal with us because it's already dealing with us. The Obama administration said, well, we're going to carefully screen the Syrian refugees. We're spending 18 to 24 months looking at their records. Well, it doesn't much matter. I mean, James Comey, the head of the FBI, and Michael Steinback, the head of FBI's counterterrorism division, have gone before Congress and said, you know, Syria's a failed state. There's no way of knowing who these people are. But the administration came back and said, oh, no, this is a very slow, deliberative process. And now, of course, that the numbers have ratcheted up, we're being told, forget 18 to 24 months. We're going to take no more than 90 days, and we're going to be moving in thousands upon thousands of people who cannot be vetted. What could possibly go wrong? So that's going on. Mr. Obama has staged another jailbreak, letting out nonviolent drug dealers in federal custody. What you need to know about that, by the way, folks, is that the feds don't generally prosecute low-level offenders. If I went to the U.S. attorney and said, you know, we just seized 5 kilos of cocaine, the U.S. attorney would probably say to me, hey, Mike, that's great. Call up the district attorney. Let the district attorney handle it. That's too small a quantity. We only deal with heavyweight quantities. So anybody who's in jail for drug trafficking probably, number one, was moving a huge amount and probably was involved with other stuff. And only a very small percentage of people who are arrested by federal agents actually ever go to trial. They plea bargain. How does plea bargain work? Make a deal with the prosecutor and they drop some of the charges. So what I want to know is of all the people that have been released by Mr. Jailbreak himself, how many of these people had been previously found in possession of guns, for example, but as a part of the plea bargain, pleaded guilty to the drugs and had the gun charge removed. But they're nonviolent because Mr. Obama says they are. We're told take bullets out of the guns of law-abiding citizens because God knows we don't want people running around with more than 10 bullets in your gun in places like New York. However, do you think that drug dealers, terrorists, or crazy people, or bank robbers are counting how many bullets they're putting in their illegal firearms? You see, if the government was in charge of the recall because of the exploding airbags that we've heard so much about, rather than give you new airbags, they'd probably tell you that the solution is to wear a Kevlar-impregnated hockey mask so when it goes off in your face, it won't kill you. It is a lack of reasoning, a lack of clear thinking, but it's not an accident. I wrote another article where I said that the failures of the immigration system are failures by design. Too many people are making too much money out of screwing Americans. And I really am convinced that perhaps the U.S. Chamber of Commerce along the way is also trying to drum up business for the funeral home industry, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, because there's no justification for anything that we're doing. We are more concerned about some 85-year-old woman in a wheelchair getting on an airplane than we are as to who we're permitting into the United States, even when the people come here from countries that sponsor terrorism, and even when they are of the right age to be involved with terrorism, which generally means early to mid-20s. By the way, I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine about what happened with USCIS and those ICE agents, and I included in my title the idea that perhaps Citizenship and Immigration Services, these DHS officials, were trying to get the MVP award, the Most Valuable Player award, from ISIS. But nobody is made accountable. And could you imagine if there had been a follow-on terrorist attack and it was then divulged that the attack could have been prevented if only the ICE agents had been given access to that file that they wanted to see? But here's something else. Imagine if they had done an investigation into the apparent marriage fraud or the alleged marriage fraud, and through that discovered that these people were involved in possible terrorism. Maybe, just maybe, on December 2nd, 2015, the San Bernardino attack might have been averted. We'll never know. But it's a disquieting thought. The idea that our government treats immigration fraud the way you would treat a parking ticket, even though, as I read to you a little while earlier, the fact that the 9/11 Commission saw immigration fraud as a key vulnerability for national security and in the ability of terrorists to enter the United States and embed themselves in the United States. It's astonishing. It's astonishing that the mainstream media, when they talk about immigration, don't bring in immigration agents. When they talk about the military, they bring in commandos and generals and admirals. When they talk about cancer, they bring in scientists and doctors and surgeons and oncologists and biochemists. when they talk about education, they bring in teachers. But now when they talk about immigration, they bring in pundits and pollsters. Isn't that remarkable? God forbid the American people should have the truth, which is why I'm very happy that I get the opportunity to do appearances over at Newsmax. I think they're doing well. I hope they do better. We need to be educated so that we can confront the politicians with all their lies and all their nonsense and all their bluff and all their bluster. You know, I was debating this guy on Dennis Michael Lynch's program, and he said, well, we need all these immigrants because they're consumers, and that's going to help the economy. What a lie. Think about it. Illegal aliens are consumers? I used to raid these apartments where these people would sleep like firewood, you know, waiting there to be burned in the furnace. You'd have 30 people, 20 people crammed into a two-bedroom apartment, sleeping on mattresses on top of each other in shifts, rats running around the apartment. You turn on the light switch. We used to call it the moving wall. There were so many insects infesting the apartment that the bugs would scatter. It looked like the fans at the football stadium doing the wave, and the stench was something you couldn't get out of your nostrils for weeks. The stench of poverty, as one of my buddies used to call it. Do you think they have disposable income at $8 an hour? To buy what? A newspaper and chewing gum? Disposable income. It's lie after lie after lie, and we're watching America go down the tubes. It's the looting of America. India, last year, got over $70 billion in remittances, money wired home by their foreign workers working not only in America but elsewhere. And when the United States said we're going to charge more for that H-1B visa application, our good friends in India threatened to go to the world court and sue the United States, litigate against us for daring to charge too much for those H-1B visas. This is madness, folks. We have no need for all this labor. We have a shortage of jobs, not a shortage of labor. You don't bring sand to the beach. And increasingly, jobs are being mechanized. Robots are doing more and more of the work. Probably mechanize our farms altogether if it became cost-effective, and maybe that is the solution. But, you know, if you watch the TV show, and I love watching it, How It's Made, watch how cars are produced today, to give you an example. When you think back to the old black-and-white grainy video footage, movie footage of the Ford factories and the Model T Fords, these big burly guys in grease-covered coveralls were manhandling the chassis, moving that car down the line from one worker to the next, adding the seats, adding the tires, adding the engine. Today, the factories look like operating rooms. It's all done by robots. The welding is done by robots. The painting is done by robots. Increasingly, human workers are going the way of the dodo bird. Is this the time when we need still more workers to come to the United States? We've got to get together, folks, as Americans, irrespective of our political orientation, and we've got to stand together and make it clear to the elected representatives, so-called, that we're not as stupid as that they hope we are. And that's the reason I do this program. That's the reason I appear on other radio shows and TV programs. And that's the reason I write for CapsWeb.org, Front Page Magazine, and The Social Contract, to try to provide you with the information you need to confront these people who allege to represent us, to make them understand that we are on to them. And it's not just for ourselves that we do this, it's for our children and for their children. Their futures hang in the balance. So I thank you for joining me on the program. I look forward again to seeing you again next time, next week, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Please join my Bucket Brigade of Truth and tell as many of your friends and family members about my program and about my website. And please remember, folks, that democracy is not a spectator sport. See you next week. In the meanwhile, have a wonderful weekend. And to all your moms out there, I wish you all a happy Mother's Day. Good night, everybody.